get that going.
Right. And I can't see anything really. I see a light that says Eugene is recording the call, right. Which is so that both parties know that.
That's right.
So that we know that it's being recorded, yeah.
So I guess we should start like we did last time. I'll count down and then you kick it off.
Sounds great. Or you can kick off.
Okay. I will kick off this time, okay?
All right. Okay, sounds good.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Hello, Eugene Napick here in Toronto.
And Candy Minks here in Chicago. Good morning.
Hi, Candy. Hi. Good morning.
How are you today?
Let's all talk at once today.
Yeah, that'd be so unusual, wouldn't it?
You know what we should do? I'm gonna recount us down since the first minute of this is all us talking over each other.
Oh, I love that. I loved what we did there.
Love what we did there.
Yeah, keep the flaws. You can decide after we do this, whatever you want to do. Recount us down.
I would feel better if we recounted this down, and then if we do it again, we'll keep it, okay?
Okay.
And I promise I won't do that again.
I promise I won't either.
Okay. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Hello, Eugene Napick here from Toronto.
Hi, and Candy Minks here in Chicago.
Hi, Candy. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How about you?
Well, I've had a morning.
Oh, you have already?
Have already. Oh, started early this morning.
Okay.
Have you ever lost something that is always in the same place? Like something you can't possibly lose because you always put it in the same place, and then you lose it and you can't find it and you search everywhere and you tear the place apart and you think it must be in the parallel universe where evil spawns.
Yes, all the time. And in fact, it happened this morning before we started talking. So I've been through the same thing this morning. Are you allowed to tell us what you lost?
Oh, absolutely. I'm going to tell you the whole sorted story.
Right. Okay.
I'm going fishing after we record this episode of the podcast. Well, I thought I'd load up the car so I'd be all ready to go. And I couldn't find my fishing vest.
Mm.
My fishing vest lives in the shed. It always lives in the same place in the shed. And it's the heart of the whole operation. It has two reels, all my flies, all my leaders and tippets and widgets and whatever I need for fly fishing is, except for my rods, is in that fishing vest. And I went to where it's supposed to be and it wasn't there.
Mm.
Somewhere way, way deep in my memory, I knew that I had done something special with it, but I couldn't remember what it was. So I started tearing apart the shed. I looked in my studio. I looked in the basement. I looked up in her bedroom. Why I would look in the bedroom, I don't know. Because certainly I could tell you that fly fishing vests aren't allowed in the bedroom. So I tore apart the shed. I tore apart the shed again. And then stuffed in a corner in the shed, I found my fishing vest. But it was completely empty. There was nothing in it at all. And I thought, oh my God, somebody has broken into our shed and stole all my valuable fly fishing stuff, my reels, my flies, everything. And then,
yeah, right.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And then I thought, oh no, I did something special with this. And suddenly it all came back to me. And I had just put it out completely out of my mind because the whole scenario was just a horrifying scenario. Back last time I went camping and fly fishing, I haven't been out much this year. The last time I went camping and fly fishing, I got all my camping gear and I got my fly fishing vest and I opened up my camping gear and it stunk.
It stunk
because there was a family of mice in my camping gear. And when I moved the camping gear around, the whole family of mice scurried out. The bushes. Hopefully they're okay. Oh yeah, it was really disconcerting.
Yeah.
And then I took all of that out. I scrubbed everything and put it all. I was like packed, ready to go camping, but I couldn't go camping right with a family of mice in my camping stuff. So I cleaned all that stuff out and then I got that packed and I got my fishing vest and my fishing vest stunk. And there's a zipper compartment in the back where you can put bottles of water and stuff. Well, there was more mice nesting material in there. So I emptied all of that out and I went camping. You can see why I forgot this. Could be
yes, purposely, right? You forgot it.
So
it's called denial.
Denial. I went camping, and every time I went out fly fishing while I was camping, I could smell mice nests. Because, you know, mice, they smell when they nest. It's just one of those things. I guess they, you know, they don't have great washroom facilities, whatever. So when I got home from my camping trip, I took everything out of my fishing vest and I hosed it down.
So had you washed it the first time?
Well, no, I didn't.
I missed that in there. So you just cleaned it out, emptied it out, and still put it on.
And then went fishing, because I was going fishing, you know. And normally I don't, like, wash my fly fishing vest. You know, I've had this fly fishing vest for maybe 20 years, and it's been washed the sum total of zero times.
And I'm thinking of all the diseases that were on that thing. I mean, I guess I would probably have thrown that fly fishing jacket out. I definitely would have tried to wash it.
But I didn't do it. I took it fishing and camping, but every time I put it on, I could smell the mice.
So gross.
So I got home and I hosed the thing out. I completely washed it and I dried it and I stuffed it in the corner of the shed once it dried. And I had all the contents in a bag in another spot in the shed. And that's why I couldn't find it. And I couldn't remember doing it because my brain conveniently just shut that right out of my memory.
Yeah, you compartmentalize that. So when was it, may I ask, how many months was that you would forget that? Or did you just maybe never go fishing again because of that mouse baby thing?
Well, you know, there was a time when I was a serious fly fisherman and I used to go all the time, but I haven't been doing it all that often. I've involved in other things that have taken my time. And the last time I went was in late spring, I guess. And I haven't been out all summer. So it's been sitting empty with all my stuff in a bag in the shed, just waiting for me to look for it. So that was my warning, knowing that I had scheduled this meeting with you and I had a limited amount of time and I'm scurrying around because I wanted fishing this afternoon in the worst way. And so I was just ripping the shed apart because, you know, I don't know if you've seen our shed, but it is not neat. It is just a pile of stuff in a shed. So I took everything out of the shed and then I found it and then pieced everything back together. And now life is good.
Good. You know, if it was my family, we would have raised those baby mice. Now, hold on for a second. I'm going to close the window here because I hear a jackhammer. There we go. I remember my grandfather. They had a summer camp that we went to all summer with our grandparents. And my grandfather died when I was pretty young. It's a very powerful memory of mine of opening up the awning every spring. You open up the camp. You undo things in the awning, one of those classic striped green and orange awnings, and a family of baby squirrels falling out. And my grandfather running around, catching them, and he caught one. And he lived with us for 5 years or more. Peanuts, the squirrel, was part of our family pet fetish.
Did you make friends with him?
Oh, my God. He was my best friend. He lived with us. He lived in the house with us, Eugene. At the same time that we had Teddy, the puppy, three or four Siamese cats, and a pet monkey called Jeep. So, I mean, that's another story for another day maybe. But, we always had these crazy animals. And, I mean, Peanuts would get out every now and then. And I remember my mother leaping over fences to catch him and bring him back in the house, the poor squirrel. But he also was very friendly with us and very tame. He got away eventually.
Probably when the food supply wasn't his choice.
Right. And he actually lived near our house in Winnipeg when he got out. I saw him all the time when I would walk to school because he had a stubby tail. So
Did he stop to say hi?
Yeah, he would be twittering at me. He didn't want to come back home, but I still saw him out there. So okay. I don't know what to say.
Speaking of pets, on our first episode, I told you that our Newfie dog, George, had a cut paw.
Right.
And I took him on Friday to the vet.
Mm.
And the vet said, you have to leave him here for a while. We're going to sedate him, thoroughly clean this wound out, and we're going to bandage him up. And so he was at the vet most of the afternoon.
Yeah.
It turned out that the cut, I guess it had got infected and it had kind of spread deep underneath the pad.
Hey.
So the vet flushed everything out and trimmed off any dead tissue and put on what's called a sugar bandage. I'd never heard of a sugar bandage. Have you heard of that?
I have not. I'm kind of surprised by that. I have not heard of it.
What they did, and I have pictures, so I will I will post on our Facebook page.
Good.
Later. What they do is they make a slurry of sugar with a little bit of water, and then they paint the sugar on the wound. Lots and lots of it. Like a quarter inch of this sugary goo they put on the wound, and then they wrap it up and they bandage it. And the sugar apparently draws out the infection. As our vet said,
fantastic.
It's old school, but it works.
I love it. And so, I can't believe that. I mean, that salt would hurt. It would draw it out, but it would be painful. So I'm assuming the sugar is milder.
Well, after we got him home on Friday, he was a bit groggy from the sedation. But after that, he had a great weekend. He seemed to be not in any discomfort. He had a nice blue wrapper on his left paw, but he seemed to be fine. And then Monday morning, I took him back to the vet and we changed the bandage and they put another sugar bandage on and it was looking considerably better.
Good.
Still, it has a lot of healing to do, but considerably better. Like,
good.
It's like, oh, we're on the right track. He's definitely starting to heal up. He's not in any discomfort now. He doesn't get to go for walks for probably another week or so. He just goes out to the backyard to do his business and then come back in. But I'm happy to report he is doing a lot better.
Wow. This also reminds me, I wanted to talk about something we talked about last week too. It's not really a fix it because we've thought about if we screw up, we're going to have a fix it corner, but this is just a follow through. I was thinking so much about the, idea of these, neighborhoods and Asian, immigrants who were afraid of these numbers of houses. And, you know, coincidentally, I didn't notice that we talked about fear of houses later. I didn't do that on purpose. It just came up. And I noticed it once I was listening to the podcast. And I started thinking, well, what else is circling around here? And why are these numbers frightening for some people? I found an article that called it superstition. I do not like to term things like that superstitious because it's only superstitious from our own world. I have two aspects here. I don't know if I'm going to read out loud. I'm thinking of reading it out loud. I don't know how long it's going to take.
Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. I've got two things. So one thing I spent the morning looking for is I have a photographic memory for things in books. I can remember, find the page that something was written on. It's just a little thing. I don't know why I have that. In general, I have a very heightened memory, but today I have this challenge of finding a book I want to find. Usually I know where they are, but today I was unpacked every book and everything and dust is everywhere. The house is a nightmare. I finally found the book. But first I found something that in standard Chinese, the number 4 sounds like the word death in Chinese.
Ah.
So isn't that interesting? And then we talked about fear of death associated with housing in terms of that serial killer, would you stay in the house or not? So unbeknownst to both of us, we had a full circle in there, which of course, you know, goes with the whole idea that everything is connected. So I thought that was pretty cool. And then Richmond Hill in Ontario, they passed a law that no new number 4s will be used in street addresses.
Oh, and that makes perfect sense because there's a significant rise in Asian Canadian population in that area.
There you go. And that was in 2013, I think. So I was kind of impressed by that. And it's also called tetraphobia. I did not look up the word. It seemed kind of, I think tetra means numbers, right, in Greek. Anyway, there is a name for it. So there you go, which is maybe less offensive than superstition. So one of our listeners, and by listeners, I mean my husband, Stag, he recommended that I look at this book by Mark Twain. So I wasn't expecting to go so far back in time, but here's something kind of interesting about names on houses. The names are plainly marked on the corners. This is actually from an essays by Mark Twain, which I was kind of impressed that Stig read it. Anyway, the names are plainly marked on the corners, on all the corners. There are no exceptions. And this is in Germany, Berlin, Germany. And it must be, when did Mark Twain live? Like 100 years ago? 150 years ago? I actually don't know when he lived. Okay, but the numbering of the houses, there has never been anything like it since original chaos. It is not possible that it was done by the wise city government. At first, one thinks it was done by an idiot, but there is too much variety about it for that. An idiot could not think of so many different ways of making confusion and propagating blasphemy. The numbers ran up one side of the street and down the other. That is endurable, but the rest isn't. They often use one number for three or four houses, and sometimes they put the number on only one of the houses and let you guess at the others. Sometimes they put a number on a home, 4, for instance, then put 4A, 4B, 4C on the succeeding houses, and one becomes old and decrepit before he finally arrives at 5. A result of this systemless system is that when you are at number 1 in a street, you haven't any idea how far it may be to number 150. It may be only 6 or 8 blocks, or it may be a couple of miles. Frederick Street is long and is one of the great thoroughfares. The other day, a man put up his money behind the assertion that there were more refreshment places on that street than numbers on the houses, and he won. There were 254 numbers and 357 refreshment places. Yet, as I have said, it is a long street. But the worst feature of all this complex business is that Berlin, the numbers do not travel in any one direction. No, they travel along until they get to 50 or 60, perhaps. Then suddenly you find yourself in the hundreds, maybe 140. Maybe the next will be 139. Then you perceive by that sign that the numbers were now traveling toward you from the opposite direction. They will keep that sort of insanity up as long as you travel that street. Every now and then, the numbers will turn and run the other way. As a rule, there is an arrow under the number to show by the direction of its flight which way the numbers are proceeding. There are a good many suicides in Berlin. I have seen 6 reported in a single day. There is always an ideal of learned and laborious arguing and ciphering going on as the cause of this state of things. If they will set to work and number their houses in a rational way, perhaps they will find out what was the matter. So I thought that was kind of cute, and it was great to have feedback. And just how we look at numbering houses in general, it's not just immigrants to Canada. There's all kinds of weird things going on. Sure. And then I remembered the book I was looking for today was a book by Roland Barthes called Empire of Signs, and it's a fascinating book about the imaginary Japan.
Just before you go there,
let me just pipe in
and say that Mark Twain lived from 1835 to 1910, and Tom Sawyer was published in 1876, and The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn in 1884. So post Civil War America.
Thank you. Both of which I have read, but I had no idea in my mind right now when this was, and I was going to look up when these essays were written, but let's just guess it must have been around then.
Yeah, I had no idea he lived in Berlin. However, before you go on Barth, and I don't know if what I'm going to tell you is factual or not, but this has you mentioned Mark Twain, and we seem to be digressing all over the place, so I'm just going to bring this up. And also, I'm sure you were just waiting for me to find a way to bring folk music into the conversation.
I was hanging.
We play a tune called Mississippi Sawyer, and a Mississippi Sawyer it doesn't refer to someone who saws things, apparently. Apparently what a Mississippi Sawyer is a log. We would call it a deadhead. It's a log that sits just under the surface, and in the Mississippi, it would be a big danger to steamboats because if you hit it, it could sink the steamboat or wreck the paddle wheel or whatever. So a Sawyer, a Mississippi Sawyer, is something that looks innocuous on the surface, but is actually can cause you a lot of trouble. And I wondered when I found that out, if that is where the name Tom Sawyer came from.
I'm going to guess yes, because you know where the name Mark Twain came from, don't you?
No, I don't.
It's a measurement in the depth of water And he worked on a steamboat. He was part of that culture. So his real name was Samuel Clemens, and he changed it to a cool name like Mark Twain. And Twain would be a number two, I think, right? I don't know whether... anyway, it's a measure. The mark is Twain.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, you would call that out when you were going through the river. Isn't that great?
It really is.
I'm sure he was naming this innocuous fellow who could be quite dangerous, because he kind of was. He was like a Dennis Menace for his time. Dennis the Menace for his time.
Well, that's exactly it. Yeah. So anyway, I interrupted you. You were going to talk
about it. Not at all. No, that's great. I mean, I just wanted to find something that kind of addressed this idea. See what I did there? Something that... related to how we look at housing and numbering. So this is about Japan, and it's written in the maybe late 70s. Roland Barthes was obsessed with Japan, and it was before anime. I read this quite a long time, right when Japanese culture was coming to America in pop culture like insane. Anyway, the streets of the city have no names. There is, of course, a written address, but it has only a postal value. It refers to a plan by districts and by blocks, in no way geometric, knowledge of which is accessible to the postman, not to the visitor. The larger city in the world is practically unclassified. The spaces which compose it is in detail are unnamed. This domiciliary obliteration seems inconvenient. Oh, I had to get through those words, sorry. Inconvenient to those like us, who have been used to asserting that the most practical is always the most rational, a principle by virtue of which the best urban toponymy would be that numbered streets, as in the United States or in Kyoto, a Chinese city. Tokyo, meanwhile, reminds us that the rational is merely one system among others. For there to be a mastery of the real, in this case the reality of addresses, it suffices that there be a system, even if the system is apparently illogical, uselessly complicated, curiously disparate. A good bricklage can not only work for a very long time, as we know, it can also satisfy millions of inhabitants inured. Furthermore, to all the perfections of technological civilizations, anonymity is compensated for by a certain number of expedients. At least this is how they look to us, whose combinations form a system. One can figure out the address by a written or printed schema of orientation, a kind of geographical summary which situates the domicile starting from a known landmark, a train station, for instance. The inhabitants excel in these impromptu drawings, where we see being sketched right on the scrap of paper a street, an apartment house, a canal, a railroad line, a shop sign, making the exchange of addresses into a delicate communication in which a life of the body, an art of the graphic gesture, recurs. It is always enjoyable to watch someone write, all the more so to watch someone draw. From each occasion when someone has given me an address in this way, I retain the gesture of my interlocutor, reversing his pencil to rub out with the eraser at its other end, the excessive curve of an avenue, the intersection of a viaduct. Through the eraser is an object. Though the eraser is an object contrary to the graphic tradition of Japan, this gesture will produce something powerful. My mic protector is falling over. Oh, there's no end of excitement today.
With finding technical things. Details will will follow us around through these podcasts, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Candy is now screwing on her thing, her object there.
Yep, the pop protector, whatever. Okay. Right. All right, hopefully that's... Oh, it's going to fall off.
I think they call it a windscreen.
Windscreen, okay. So. Yeah, the glue's come right off of the things. I'm just going to jam it on the table. Sorry, everybody had to hear that. I have a ridiculous setup here. Anyway, I think I read most of my gist of that in some way. If anybody wants to read it, I can put the rest of it on Facebook or something. I mean, it's basically talking about a decentralized city that doesn't even have addresses, which is amazing. There goes my thing again.
I'm enjoying your technical struggles, I have to say.
I'm in hell over here right now.
While you're fixing that, I wanted to mention something that came up in current events, and maybe it's from the Life Imitates Art or Art Imitates Life department.
Right.
You know, Sheila and I have been watching the FX TV series, The Americans, avidly. We're really enjoying it. And, you know, we were thinking about how outlandish some of the spy shit is that these guys get involved with. I mean, I don't know what other words to use for it, but spy shit is sort of appropriate. You know, they go out and they blackmail people, they're killing people, they're stealing information, they're bugging places. And you know, spy stuff goes on, but I guess post-Cold War, you don't hear maybe as much of it, although certainly all that business with the Russians trying to affect the last American election, I guess that's spy shit too, isn't it?
No kidding.
But what came on the news the other day, but a senior RCMP intelligence officer, one of the highest ranked intelligence officers, has been busted for attempting to sell scads of sensitive information. And apparently it includes like lists of personnel or agents or something like that. I don't know any more details. They're keeping pretty quiet, but they've got the guy in custody, and they've charged him with a number of offenses that all come down to spying on a really, really high level. And on the CBC the other day, one commentator referred to the information or the stealing of that information or the selling of that information as devastating and potentially hugely harmful to Canada's reputation in the international community.
Wow. Yeah, so definitely.
Go figure. That stuff is going on, and it's going on around us all the time.
I'm ashamed of the RCMP for doing that, especially after everything with Edward Snowden and the NSA. It's disgusting. But, you know, hopefully they figure it out. And I hope it's not on people's personal lives and homes. That's what I hope. And it sounds like it is, but I hope it's not. But it's against protesters, right? They were really marking down protesters. Like every paranoid movie fantasy about standing up against the man, they were actually doing.
I hadn't read that. What I had read was that he had gathered terabytes of data that involved all kinds of things, but they weren't being very specific in the reports up here.
Oh,
so hopefully we'll know a little bit more.
Right.
I can't really say more because I've just read a couple of news reports.
Right. I don't know everything. I took a quick look at it and I thought it had to do with protesters. So I wasn't really sure. You know what? I've got a couple other things on mind that still relate to last week. Is that, guess what? We had not just my husband was listening. We had a couple of other people that were listening, and we had two emails. So I just want to read out one sentence in one of these because I don't know where it's going to go, but it gave me a thought. So this was from Fox, and he says, just a quick thought on one of the subjects discussed. Reusing old folk song melodies might be more acceptable than old pop tunes because more of those copyrights may have expired and not been renewed. Is that exactly what we're talking about, or is it related to? Because in some ways, my impression of this whole issue about originality, I mean, Vox is absolutely right. He's correct. That's right. That is why it's a non-big deal to use those old folk tunes. However, are we talking about something more philosophical about who owns something or how you own something? I don't know. Did you feel that you've reached an idea there?
Well, I guess underlying that is the idea that in folk music, it isn't just about the copyright. It's also, there's a folk music process. We own this together. We own these songs together. We own these tunes. The tunes grow and evolve over time. Melodies get reused all the time. And I think the point that I was trying to get at was that it was an attitude as much as anything else that made it not litigious in the folk music community. But I'm sure in some cases Vox has a point there.
Right. Which I think he does have a point. I just wasn't sure whether we had really kind of covered that as a philosophical thing. The other thing is, I think some music is slowly being found out to be owned by somebody or written. And I suppose that changes it. I don't have an example. I know I've heard an example where maybe there was an old-timey song, and it turns out that by the way it was written, and they follow through, you know, ethnomusicologists and for maybe forensic studies of the language, they figure out that it was owned by a certain fellow or woman, and they can find that, and then it has to get credit, at least if it's used. Whether or not there's a financial situation with that, I'm not sure.
I guess philosophically, the question is, can we own the art that we make and share with one another in our communities?
Right. That is a good philosophical question.
Right. And what you said last week was lawyers. And I think you're absolutely right.
Right.
I think the problem we have with the music business is the business part of it. You know, it becomes something that we own, and there's a lot of money involved in it. And there's a lot of people who want a share of that custard pie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. You
know? But with, for instance, old time music, the best old time performances I've ever heard have been at campsites at festivals, where really some of the most accomplished players around get together and share music together. Nobody buys tickets for the concert. Nobody, it's not like that kind of transaction. It's we sit around the campsite and we play. And if you can keep up, you get to play along, which is pretty
right.
cool.
Right.
And, you know, if I wanted to go and meet Eric Clapton, for instance, mm-hmm. well, how easy would that be? That would be pretty difficult, right? There would be a whole pile of security and difficulty, and getting through to a star like that would be really,
right.
really hard.
Right.
But I can go down, you know, I wasn't able to go to the Rockbridge Festival, which was recently held in Virginia, because Sheila unfortunately broke her wrist just at that time. But at a festival like that, you can see people of the same stature, but in a world in which there isn't really a whole lot of money. So there are some old time performers who have a few recordings that they can sell, and they get to teach at camps and that kind of environment. And I know some folks who do reasonably well between a little bit of touring and lots of teaching. Maybe teaching is the bulk of their income. They can scratch out a living. And that's not a bad thing. Sometimes I think of what Utah Phillips, the golden voice of the Great Southwest, said. He wanted to make a living, not a killing. And he was contacted, and there's somewhere on YouTube, I'll try to find it and post it. There's an interview with him in which he talks about this. He was contacted by Johnny Cash, and Johnny Cash wanted to record some of his songs. And of course, the way legally it's set up, he can demand a license and record the songs. Anyone can record anyone's songs. You just have to pay royalties.
Okay.
But he was being cool about it, and he contacted Utah and said, "Hey, I'd like to do this." And Utah said, "I'd rather you didn't."
Ooh.
And this went back and forth for some time, and he was under a lot of pressure from people in his own folk music community who said, "You know, you're going to be able to take a lot of money, which you can use to contribute to any cause you want." And Utah's response was that, well, he can't control anyone else's behavior, only his own.
Right.
And he didn't want to make money. He didn't want to make a killing off of those songs. He didn't want to contribute to that industry. He wanted to be able to use his talent and experience and performance in order to make a living, not a killing, which is a pretty interesting idea in a world where everybody wants to make a killing.
Well, that is true. I want to, in relationship, this is going to stay on topic too. is another email we got, which from David, and he wrote us, and it reflects back to what we were talking about, gentrification, Kensington Market, Sanctuary. So great first podcast. Nice to hear your voices. The Sanctuary, or as it was also called, the Skanctuary, turning into a high-end, I resemble that remark, running into a high-end, many happy hours were completely wasted at the Sanctuary. Running into a high-end coffee shop, turning into a high-end coffee shop reminded me that Queen yupped up section by section. There used to be a great Salvation Army store close to the Horseshoe. It closed and became a Le Chateau. I kind of thought that killed that block and then moved west. Le Chateau, the thrift store of fashion. So thank you very much for sending us an email and reminding me about Le Chateau. I had forgotten about that.
There was a time, and I guess we were both living maybe in that area at the time. Yeah. We had friends. I think it was, remember when Twin Peaks was on, and yes, we used to go visit our friends. They lived above the Majestic on right. Queen Street.
Right.
The Majestic, which was like, it was some kind of club.
Like a Polish club?
Yeah, I don't think it was Polish. I don't remember just...
Okay.
Just what the... It was some kind of ethnic club of some kind. But this is sort of unrelated, except it has to do with the street. But do you remember the day we were in there watching Twin Peaks and we heard the sound of a sledgehammer happening?
Yes, I do.
And we went upstairs to find the guys upstairs had stolen a parking meter, and they were using a sledgehammer to try to break into the parking meter to get at the coins inside.
I know. And they weren't even poor, really. I mean, they were, I think they had jobs. I mean, one of my friends, Mike, he was a plumber. I mean, I don't know why they were doing that, but they were hilarious. That actually turned into a great friendship. I hung out with those guys for a few years after that. And I think about them often. They were pretty cool. We had a lot of music in common, which was pretty cool. Yeah, that turned into the Munster Pub, I believe. And then now I forgot what it was. I was there the other day for the Labor Day Parade because we still stand there. That's how we ended up going to the Labor Day Parade in the beginning, was coming downstairs from Anita's place and going into the parade.
I hardly recognize the neighborhood now. I lived in the old casket factory at Tecumseh and Niagara, and I had the place with the nice floors because I guess it was the casket showroom. Right. I love that building in lots of ways, although there certainly were some challenges there. Right. And I don't know how it didn't burn down because it was the electrical could not have been safe. There's just no way. Right. But it's all condos around there. And I can remember when I lived in that warehouse, there used to be some people on Niagara Street had chickens in their backyard, and every now and then the rooster would get out and be running around on Niagara Street.
That's awesome.
And then they started decommissioning the lead smelter that was just in behind us. There were guys in spacesuits out there taking apart this building. And I'm thinking, I hope that guy wasn't eating those chickens or the eggs. Because there's the whole neighborhood had all this lead in the soil, and they removed a lot of the lead from the soil because it was some kind of, I don't know, a plating place or something.
Right, next to a slaughterhouse. So, I mean, we're probably all doomed anyway. Listen, I wanted to also mention something kind of that we did this week was we saw some of the family. Now, I'm not going to talk about the family per se. I don't want to do that to my husband, but we did have a two placenta sighting.
What?
Now, a two placenta sighting. So I'm pretty excited about that. I just wanted to report on that. Two placentas. Basically, when Steg's grandmother passed away, we were at the funeral. And a few things all happened. It was about 9 years ago, almost exactly 9 years ago, actually. And I had a whole bunch of Polish food. I think that's why it's come into my head right now, because yesterday we ate Polish food, because after any wedding or funeral, the family goes to White Eagle Banquet, which is a Polish banquet hall where you can just have a space to either do your wedding food or your reception or anything. So we did have a funeral yesterday, and it reminded me, I shouted out to Steg, "Oh my God, it's two placentas." And he's like, "Candy, stop it." So anyway, because at grandma's wake, one of the fellows, a distant relative, showed up and he was exhausted and been up all night, maybe two nights, because his wife just had twins. And so we're going, oh my God, that's so exciting. Are they identical? Are they not? And one of the other distant relatives, an in-law, said, well, how many placentas were there? Were there two placentas? And really, from now on, we just call her two placentas, because there we are, poor Stag. It's his grandmother. We're at a funeral. And it's just one of those amazing, awkward family moments that I just love. And I feel I can get away with that because no one's going to know what I'm talking about. And I, aside from that, I really do promise not to talk about Stag's family. I don't even want to talk about my family. So I get that. I just wanted to throw that in because we had a lot of delicious Polish food yesterday.
Oh, I bet.
Oh, it was fantastic.
My mouth is watering. You know, I grew up on Polish food, and I don't get to have it all that often. But interesting that you mentioned it, because we got a call yesterday from an old friend of ours, and we're going to go to a Polish restaurant and meet him next week for
dinner.
There
you go. There you go. Awesome. I have another question for you, or a question. How do you feel about screen talking?
Screen talking? What's that?
Well, yeah, I think that's because you're from Toronto, the Mecca and revered sanctuary of moviegoers. And it's very uncommon to have screen talkers. And it's very common, if someone is screen talking during a movie, for someone to say, shut up or fuck off. That doesn't really happen here. I don't know if it's across the country, but it's definitely in many Chicago theaters. And I've been in dozens since the 10 years I've been here. And screen talking seems to happen in every neighborhood.
Wow.
And I tell you, it used to make me nuts. I was probably one of the people in the, you know, the 90s who would turn around and go, fuck off, like shut the fuck up or something.
But no. I have been a shusher.
Have been a shusher.
Yes.
I do not shush anymore.
Or, you know, sometimes I won't shush, but I'll turn around and fire a look of death over at the talkers.
Yeah, it wouldn't do anything here. And besides, I'm afraid somebody would shoot me in the theater. So I don't shush anybody. And I have come to kind of have embraced it. I actually kind of enjoy it. The first time I totally enjoyed it was when we went to see The Da Vinci Code on the weekend it opened. And there were so many unusual people, and I suppose Stag and I were among them, because we had Wiccans and witches and murlocs and, I don't know, warlocks or whatever. There were so many people. And the screen talking was phenomenal. At that point, I went, I just can't fight it anymore. This is fantastic. Pardon?
Did you join in?
No. I don't join in. Not at all. But
The other afternoon, we went to see Bridget Runs a Marathon at our local Cineplex.
I almost went to see that.
Oh yeah, it's a fun movie. It's a fun movie because of Jillian Bell's performance. She's really good in it. Mm-hmm. It's lightweight time waster fluff, but I laughed quite a bit. I had a really good time in it. It is a lot of fun, and she's really, really good in it. But there was a guy sitting right beside me, and once the movie started, he had brought in some kind of beverage, okay? And he had a cup from, I guess he had, I don't know, he must have bought a beverage as well. But he had this extra beverage, and he decided at a quiet point in the movie, he started to pour his beverage into his cup. And it was really loud. And it was like a big cup, and he's pouring. It's like, glub, 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 glub.
It's probably a bottle of whiskey.
And then he stopped. And he started to laugh because he realized that he was making a lot of noise. And then everybody started to laugh.
Oh, well, that's good.
Yeah,
that
it was fun. It was fine. But it was just funny because normally we don't get a lot of screen talking. We get some here, but it depends on the movie, too, I think. In some movies, it depends on the crowd that comes. But mostly, you know, fairly polite audiences. But this guy just suddenly became self-conscious of his poor.
Funny. Well, I'm pretty noisy with food. I often bring food into the theater with me, chips or chocolate bars or something. Or I've been known to bring a six-pack of beer into the theater. So I'm I'm pouring it into
impressed.
A cup. Yeah, I'm pretty noisy.
Movie police would get us here in Canada if we had a six-pack of beer. Although in some theaters now you can buy beer. And I love going to VIP because they bring you beer and pizza. That's pretty good.
I totally love that, and I love the VIP, but I've done some of my finest work in Canadian theaters, so of contraband. So, I mean, we went to see The Doors, and we all had Mickeys. I thought you were there. There was like 10 of us.
No, I didn't see the doors.
No, you didn't see the doors. Okay. So last night we had some great screen talkers for the movie Hustlers. And it was pretty packed audience and a fantastic movie. The screen talking was adorable. I mean, the females in that audience were so engaged in the movie that it just added to me. As long as people are talking about the movie, I don't think that bothers me. Steg spends an awful lot of time actually paying attention. He can recall everything everybody said, so it's pretty funny the next day.
He has the most remarkable memory for conversations.
Totally.
He can talk back conversations we've had 20 years ago. Sometimes it scares me.
Yeah, it is scary. So he is, anyway, the movie was totally awesome. I have to actually highly, highly recommend. I'm giving it a 10 out of 10. It is definitely just for genre, the best stripper movie I've ever seen. And Wikipedia said there.
How many stripper movies have you seen?
Right, I've seen a lot. And
how many are there? I mean, there's three?
No. Wikipedia said that there are 37 films with stripping in them.
That's probably more than submarine movies.
Oh my God. I don't know. I don't think it is. But maybe, but they didn't have the night they rated Minsky's on there, which was really vaudeville. And I looked it up and it was produced by Norman Lear, which made me almost pass out. I thought that was so exciting. I have several favorite stripper movies. Dancing at the Blue Iguana, I would highly recommend. Cool movie. Probably started the whole exercise, pole dancing for Jesus, or your exercise if you want to go out there and get in shape and you want to be sexy for your partner, you'll take a pole dancing class, build up confidence. That probably started all from Dancing at the Blue Iguana. I'm a fan. Burlesque, I've probably seen 10 times. It's not really a stripper movie, but I think it does burlesque and stripping. It's involving sex workers. So I kind of call it all under the same, not the weight of a sex worker prostitution movie, but I certainly think that burlesque and stripping is similar. So anyway, it was fantastic. As soon as the movie started, I went not expecting a great movie. I love J-Lo. I think she's incredible performer. The camera loves her, so I was pretty excited to see her, but I was going to be very, very hard on her. If she didn't get down and dirty and get on that pole and be raunchy, I was going to be upset. And God love her, within the first half hour of the movie, she comes out and is the performing, you know, she's the most glamorous stripper there's ever been, and she fucking nailed it. She was fantastic. She got on the floor and twerked, and I was just very, very pleased, because if she didn't do that, I didn't think she was going to be able to break her image or add to it.
I haven't seen that film, by the way. Sheila saw it. There are some movies that I'm unlikely to go to that she goes to. We call them Friday night movies, because I often go and play Go with a friend of mine.
Right.
We've been playing Go for, as you know, some 35 years.
Right.
And that's usually Friday night. And Sheila will often pop out to see a movie while I'm playing Go. So Friday night movies that she's unlikely to be able to get me to go to, she goes to see on Friday.
Right. Well, I would highly recommend, maybe you can go to a matinee or something. I actually think you're really going to like this movie, because I found that I constantly didn't really know how I felt funny. There was things in it that were, I thought, very interesting experimental film details. On top of it, it's a female director, and I just would recommend all of my friends, please go and support female directors. And also, this is a good movie. It's a very good movie. It had surprising content that I was not expecting. I thought I was going to go, and I really wanted to see a dancing movie, lots of dancing, like Magic Mike or Striptease. Striptease didn't have that much dancing, and neither did Burlesque. But, you know, you're looking for that movie, I want a lot, but it didn't matter. Most of the dancing happened at the beginning, and the setting the tone of realism happened right at the beginning. One of the first scenes has them walking out into the strip club, and I had this horrible feeling of, like, livestock walking out, because they're all in a row. And that was incredible. It's also not just about that, okay? It's not just about, oh, we're terrible to women. It's about women being friends and empowered. It's about so many things, and I don't want to say too much about it, because it's just that fantastic. There's one scene that I can tell you that won't ruin it, where I related to it very, very much, having been in the nightclub scene myself, that walking home, and it's dawn, and you are dressed completely inappropriate for dawn. It's called the walk of shame. It can be called the walk of shame, but it also could be that you were just out clubbing, and it didn't mean you slept at someone's house and had sex and came home in your clothes. And she goes to get her daughter. Her daughter is not to be found. She finds her daughter. The babysitter had to go and took the daughter to a neighbor. And I mean, the realism and the heartfelt being a single parent, it just hit me so powerfully. And I thought, good for them. And, you know, being judged for being in your clothes and you're really cute and you're wonderful and you're seizing the day and you love life, and then people just judging you for it. So it nailed it on a lot of things. The relationships are very good. The dialogue is appropriate and fantastic. It's 10 out of 10 and I highly recommend it.
Okay, that's a big recommendation. I'm going to try to get out to see it. And I will say, I have a tendency to just go see the movies that I think I'm going to like. But I am making an effort. Normally, a movie called Bridget Runs a Marathon is not one that would call out to me. But I went to see that with Sheila the other day. And we also watched last night what might be the total antithesis of a stripper movie. we saw it on DVD. It's a movie with Matt Damon and Scarlett Johansson from a few years ago. I think it was 2012. And it's called We Bought a Zoo.
Oh, yeah. I did not see that.
It's a bit saccharine, but it's well performed. It's a film about a guy who has two kids. One is 7 and the other's 14, and his wife who he's madly in love with gets sick and dies. And this guy is like a guy who's always been an adventure seeker, but he's really kind of lost and he wants something. He doesn't know what it is. And he decides he's just going to move. He's going to move his kids, new school, new place, just someplace where he can start over again. And he finds this place that he's really attracted to and discovers it's an old zoo. Mm-hmm. And all the animals are there, and the state has continued to have zookeepers look after the animals while they try to figure out what to do with this property. And this guy and his kids move into this ramshackle house, and they have this whole family of zookeepers there, and they decide he wants to get the zoo to be running again. Of course, there's through the film, there's a relationship that grows between him and Scarlett Johansson, and between the 14-year-old kid and a 14-year-old girl who works there part-time. And it's just charming as all get out. The whole movie, it's just so charming you can hardly stand it. But nonetheless, it was enjoyable, and the performances were good, even though there were a number of scenes in which you'd see Matt Damon and I was pretty sure any second now he was going to start running and there would be explosions. The CIA would be on his tail, but none of that happened.
Okay. Well, I'm going to check it out. It's a weird that I haven't seen it, because I like I want all my novels and movies to be interspecies. That's what I just love it. I like to have animals and humans interacting. So I should see that. And it sounds very John Irving. You know, instead of buying a hotel in New Hampshire, they bought a zoo. It sounds up my alley.
Sure. Speaking of novels, what are you reading these days?
I am not reading anything for the last 2 weeks. I'd have to go look on the other shelf to see what I've got there. I'm blank because I've just been way too busy. I had a lot of commitments. Things. Oh, you do? Good.
A few things going book-wise. One is I've been reading Mindhunter by John Douglas
and his
ghostwriter, I guess. I think it's his ghostwriter, Mark Olshaker, I guess.
Are you sure it's not one of the other FBI guys? No?
I think I could be. I could be wrong on that, so I'll back off on my saying he's the ghostwriter. But he could be one of the... Well, the thing is, in the book, he doesn't mention this guy, which is, I guess, why I thought
that's
maybe
weird.
He was the ghostwriter. I started reading it because I had watched both seasons of Mindhunter, the show, and I'm kind of stalled in this one. It's interesting enough, but it's really a memoir of this guy and his adventures as an FBI agent. But what it doesn't have, which the TV show is full of, is the story of the agents. It's not about that at all. It's really all about this is the how we developed this this way of profiling, and here's how it worked when I interviewed this serial killer and that serial killer. So it's interesting. But what I liked about the TV show is that the more the characters interacted with the serial killers and the more they got into that world, the darker their own characters became. And I thought that was splendidly interesting.
It has been splendidly interesting. And I think, though, it's also because they're getting fame. It's not it may not be because of the serial killers. It may be because they're getting renown. Like Holden, he's getting cocky. You know, and I really love Holden. I asked two of my girlfriends, a married couple, and they start watching Mindhunter. I was very surprised. I was like, well, do you love Holden? They're like, no. So I thought that was pretty cool because I love him. But the dark side is that he's getting arrogant. And I don't know how they're going to take that into further seasons or not. But, you know,
well,
for me, he's the life of the TV show. I love all the characters, but I'm really compelled by him.
I'm a little bit stalled on that. I'm going to get back to it soon. And and I also discovered he's written tons of books, including manuals and for FBI agents and that kind of thing. This guy is very active as a writer. I had no idea. So John Douglas. So I'll get back to that. And I might find that it's more interesting than I thought it was. I also wanted to talk, though, about some graphic novels.
Okay.
Do you know that the first graphic novel I ever read, you gave me?
I'm not surprised by that.
It was many, many years ago. I don't remember
the title. Better be Tank Girl.
It was a Western.
Oh.
It was a Western. I don't remember what it was called. It didn't really resonate with me. The pace didn't seem right. And I know you were trying to encourage me to become interested in graphic novels, and well, that idea flopped. I wasn't at all. And I really didn't get interested in graphic novels at all until I started writing one. And I only started writing one because I had written a book of stories, as you know, called The Lazy Ellen Stories, available on Amazon. And my friend Jacob read the stories and said, these need to be a graphic novel. I'll illustrate it. So we've been working on Squeezebox Man, the graphic novel, and we have two issues out so far. We're working on the third. And incidentally, if anyone's interested in those, you can send a note to 27th Street Press, 278th Street Press @gmail.com. And I'll be happy to sell you those. But I started reading graphic novels because I figured if I'm going to script these stories and new stories as well, I better immerse myself in this world a little bit because it's a whole genre that I kind of avoided. And in part, it's because I'm not impressed with superheroes. And the superheroes really dominate that, you know? So I started looking into it. And of course, I came across R. Crumb, which is pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. And then Harvey Pekar, who American Splendor, I just love. I gobbled up American Splendor. And I really liked the everydayness of it, you know, his life in Cleveland and his dysfunction and his troubles and his illnesses and how autobiographical it was. I really, really enjoyed. And then I came across some other ones recently that I wanted to mention that are really interesting in different ways. One of them is called Leaving Richard's Valley by a guy named Michael DeForge. And it's a new book. It's a really handsome little hardcover. It's got a silver and black cover to it. It looks really good. You know, really flashy when you see it. And it's a story illustrated with very, very simple line drawings mostly. And the characters there are some humans, but they're mostly animals, and the animals are very much drawings. You know, there's not like an effort to make them realistic or veristic in any kind of way. And it tells the story about these animals who live in a valley outside the city, and it's Richard's Valley because Richard runs a cult. And they're living in Richard's cult. And, you know, humans being humans and all, the ideal cult life just doesn't completely work out. And some of these animals end up having to leave Richard's Valley, leave the cult and re-enter into the world. And so it's this story of these animals going to the city and, you know, eating out of dumpsters and that kind of thing, trying to find housing. And it's quite humorous. It's something unexpected for me is really a new sort of kind of storytelling. And I really enjoyed that. I wanted to share it. A couple others. Bastard by Max de Rodriguez. It's
I like also, the title.
Also fairly new, and it combines a heist story and a dysfunctional family story for the modern age.
Wow.
with really nice, readable, flowing drawings. I like the way that the drawings are paced. You bomb your way through this. You read this graphic novel very fast, and it has to do with the way the drawings propel you through it. Very, very nice. Really interesting content. Something that, I wouldn't really expect. And then the other one I wanted to mention is an older one. It's from 1999, and it's by Julie Doucette, who has since left the graphic novel world. She's an artist from Montreal, and My New York Diary is very autobiographical, much in the way that Harvey Pekar's work is. And it's a story of her as a young woman packing up her bags and moving to New York. And we meet her jealous boyfriend, and they take lots of drugs and drink too much and don't have enough money and have all those sorts of adventures in the book. And it has a much different kind of drawing in it, and it's a very curious thing with the drawing in this book. The drawings are extremely dense, and when I started to read them, I thought, I'm not going to be able to read this, because there's so much packed into each drawing that for me, when I started reading it, it didn't really have a kind of cadence to it. It wasn't a page turner, you know. And then as I started going through it, my brain adjusted to this way of visual storytelling, and suddenly I could read the drawings. It was a really interesting thing that happened. And I think that I had to remap my brain in a way to be able to read these things.
Sure.
And at a certain point, suddenly I was with the story, and I was propelled through the story, and it's excellent work. Highly recommend it. So Leaving Richard's Valley, Bastard, My New York Diary, and American Splendor, all recommended.
All right. Fantastic. Very good. I'm going to try and check some of them out. I have some news. I got a post office box in case someone wants to write us and they didn't want to write an email. So I'm going to post that on one of our Facebook pages because I wasn't prepared. Steg reminded me 100 times, put the address right in front of you. And I, of course, forgot. So I don't have it on me, but we do have a post office box if anyone wants to send us a letter or a message and they're not comfortable with email.
Excellent. And we'd love to have your letters and your opinions, and we'd be happy to talk about them in future episodes.
Definitely. And our email address is theagency.podcast@gmail.com.
So send us your opinions. I hope you're enjoying the podcast so far.
I got to tell you, it made my week, Eugene, because it made me think about things differently. It activated my thinking processes, and I really enjoyed that just when we did the podcast and then how it affected my life. Just added a whole new layer of meaning for getting through my week, you know? Thank you.
Absolutely. I would like to be able to say that we're up on iTunes and people can subscribe to us. And I was going to ask people that they could go to iTunes and they could rate our podcast and rate reviews and those good things. But we're not up on iTunes. And why are we not up on iTunes? Because somehow when I submitted it, I thought that it was successfully submitted. But when I went back 4 days later wondering why we weren't up there yet.
Right.
And I checked the status. It turns out you can go into iTunes and check the status. There was no sign of any status.
Well, the good news is by the time we publish this podcast, we will be on iTunes. So that's the good news.
I hope so. I'm expecting today or tomorrow. All now that I've discovered the problem, I've resubmitted it and I've verified that I've successfully submitted it.
Great.
So, you know, we're proving to be technically challenged, the both of us.
Yeah, as I knock the table that's holding the mic protector. Yes, yeah, the wind guard. So sorry.
I don't even mind telling our listeners out there that that we had trouble connecting a Skype call this morning.
Totally. And but this week, what I did accomplish, because it's a learning curve, is that I've got a big tray here on a comfy chair next to me. I'm on an uncomfortable chair that I can hear squeaking the entire time we talk. I've got a wobbly table holding the mic protector and the pop guard or wind guard, but I have a nice comfy chair with a big tray and a pot of tea. So that was good. If you're hearing me pour something, I was going to drink wine and I decided to drink tea instead.
I'm drinking tea too. I think tea is going to be the official drink of the Agency Podcast.
It's possible. I may transgress. You never know.
But that's
so
true.
Far, if, tea.
For, so far, yeah, tea. So far it's tea.
Yeah.
So
I mean, I'm not going to do ayahuasca or anything like crazy like that, but I certainly might have a glass of wine one of these days.
Well, if you're going to have a glass of wine, I'll have a glass of wine.
All right. So double dog dare. We'll see how it goes. thanks so much for listening. I think, are we going to head out? You got to go fishing, right?
I am going to go fishing. So, so thank you, Candy. And we'll be back at you next week.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Bye.
Bye. Okay, before you cut it off, let's make sure we recorded that. Or whatever. You still there?